Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, December 11th, 2011, and this is show number 343. Well, my mom's on the mend, finally, so things are getting back to normal around here. She was really enjoyed all your well wishes. I read her every tweet you guys send, and she loves it. So she's back on track here. Not completely out of the woods, but everything's looking pretty good. Well, before we kick into the show, I wanted to give you yet another reminder that if you're going to be shopping at Amazon anyway, it would sure help the show if you use the Amazon's affiliate link in the left-hand sidebar over on podfeet.com. All you have to do is there's a little search window in there. Just put your search term right there or hit the link and go directly to Amazon and start searching. And anything you buy in that session will send around 3% plus or minus donated back to the show coffers. Also, if you're buying from the Mac App Store, there's an affiliate link on the right-hand side of podfeet.com that does the same thing, but goes through Apple. I really appreciate you helping us out. I'd also like to remind you that we've got the RSVP system set up for the NoSilla Castaways party at Macworld iWorld. If you go to podfeet.com, in the menu bar, you should see a link that says NoSilla Castaways party. Click that, and then it's going to ask you for a password and enter all as one word, screen steps, all lowercase. And then you can enter your name and email address, and you're on the list. I plan to assign bouncers this year. I'm thinking maybe if I buy them refreshments, say Barry Fulk, Paul Shadwell, and Guy Searles. Can you imagine somebody trying to break into the party if we had that going on? Last year, there was a little bit of a disaster of a woman gave out the name and time of the party to just anybody, and that's not really what this party is about. This is for the real NoSilla Castaways. If you're in town near San Francisco and not going to Macworld and you want to show up, that would be great too. But be sure to RSVP or you'll be waiting out in the cold because those boys are not letting you in. The party will be Friday night, the 27th of January from 6 to 8 p.m. I sure hope to see a lot of you there. We've already got a great list of attendees in the list. Most of the Mac Roundtable is RSVP too, so even if you don't want to come see me, come see them. All right, enough public service announcements. Let's dig in. So you remember a couple weeks ago I told you about the Jot Pro from Adonit and how it had finally solved the stylus problem? How it had what felt like a pointed tip, but then actually had a little flat disc on the end of it that made the correct contact with the iPad. Well, before I did that review, my friend John Melanson was getting ready to do a review of a completely different stylus. He came over to see me and sheepishly said that he had this other stylus, but I probably wouldn't want to see it because he'd heard me talking about the Jot Pro and how cool it was. Well, it turns out, though, that by the time he walked to my office, which was after I did the recording, the Jot Pro had failed on me. I have no idea what's going wrong with it, but now it skips. I can't write with it anymore at all. I don't understand how something so basically mechanical can be failing. It's not like there's an electrical circuit going on in here, but it acts like it's running out of ink, which makes no sense at all. Now, here's the weird thing. The same Jot Pro does work for my friend Niraj. And I mean, I have tried every angle. I can't figure out how he would be writing and I'm holding it differently or I'm pushing too hard on the screen, but it simply doesn't work for me at all now. I should say that the pen did roll off the table and fell about 2 feet onto carpet, and the plastic disc popped off the point, but I was able to pop it back on, and I don't know, could that have broken it? I went to the Adonit website, and they had a couple of suggestions. One was to clean the disc and the iPad. Ooh, I was excited about that, but it didn't help. Now, the other really bizarre solution was to turn on the simplified Chinese keyboard, the one that's made for handwriting. I guess it makes some kind of sense, because the Chinese really do have to draw their characters, right? Well, I was willing to try anything, but sadly that didn't fix it up either. Anyway, I wrote a note to the Adonit folks telling them of my strife, and I suspect we'll get this thing fixed up. Maybe it is just a problem with the tip. They do sell refill tips, which is kind of funny. So the good news is that John did get to show me his stylus after all. This is a much cheaper, but sausage-like solution. John's stylus choice is the Amazon Basic, which runs about $11.08. It's a short black cylinder with a dome-shaped rubber tip. The tip is sort of like an inflated half cylinder, so it's fun to compress it. But how well does it write? Would you believe it writes really, really well and doesn't skip?
Hi, Allison and the NoSilla Castaways. Shy here, calling from the Golden Princess cruise ship, currently sailing around Hawaii. Now, I love my iPhone, and I love apps. We all love apps, though this love affair can turn out to significantly lighten our wallet if we aren't careful. I've found a solution. I have an app for you that can help with our app collecting addiction. And best of all, it's free. It's called Apps Gone Free by App Advice. These are the guys that bring you the video podcast App Advice Daily, hosted by the charming and bubbly Robin Reese. This app tells you every day applications that have, you guessed it, just become free, usually for a limited time. Each day you get shown about half a dozen apps for iOS devices, from all genres, games, utilities, productivity, photography, etc. Now, I don't tend to find all of the apps they show interesting, but occasionally I find a gem and thank the app for saving me $5 or $6. On a side note, I haven't had the chance to try this application outside of the US App Store, so for international listeners, I really hope it works for you, and I haven't just raised your hopes high and smashed them to the ground. This is a great app, and I can see it being extremely useful for anyone on a budget, short on cash, or just wanting to save money, as you eye the more expensive apps in the App Store. Go check out Apps Gone Free and satisfy your app-collecting appetite. Well, that's it for now. I must say it's nice to be able to tell you about a free app rather than tempting you with wonderful video or photographic plugins that seem to cost a small fortune. So to all of the Nosilla castaways around the world, this is Shai Yamini, sending a big mahalo and aloha from Hawaii.
Well, Shai, that is good that for once you're giving us something that's not going to cost us a fortune. Some of your tips have been pretty expensive to the old pocketbook, that's for sure. It's fantastic to have you back after such a long absence. And congratulations on your impending wedding. In a couple of weeks, Shai is going to be a married man. He's getting married in Thailand. How cool is that? Well, about a year ago, I was chatting with Katie Floyd about backups and my desire to find a use for our Drobo. Steve is happily keeping his raw video and his in-work video projects on the Drobo, but I couldn't find a reason for it for me. Katie uses CrashPlan for her backups, while I'm a super-duper fan myself. Katie gave me her backup script, but then assumed that I had a clue what to do with it. Well, I asked Dorothy to help me out. The Nosilla Castaways know her better as Mac Lurker in the live chat room and on Twitter. Dorothy may have regretted agreeing to do this because I managed to make this into a doctoral dissertation by the time we were done. So let's back up a little bit and explain why this is so hard. It turns out that while I can see the Drobo on the network at all times, it's not actually mounted like a normal drive. It also turns out that to back up using SuperDuper to a network volume, you have to back up to what's called a sparse image. I don't entirely even understand what a sparse image is, even though I've heard John and Dave discuss it at length on the Mac Geek app. I can't explain how it acts, though. It's a disk image that grows to match what you put in it. So that's like my big explanation. So I created a sparse image on the Drobo, mounted it, and then had SuperDuper do a small backup to it. That worked just fine. But what I wanted from Dorothy's programming mojo was much, much more. I wanted to be able to open my laptop at 5:30 a.m. when I spring out of bed each morning, because I am just that much of a morning person, and as I wander off to do my morning ablutions, this magical script would mount the Drobo and the sparse image, start the backup, and let me know at the end whether it was successful, and then put all the tools away when it was done. For some reason, Dorothy thought this sounded like fun. Now remember, she had to build this at her house without a Drobo and make gobs of comments to show me exactly where I had to change the names of the volumes and the scripts in SuperDuper. Oh, I almost forgot. She also had to tell me that there are backup scripts inside SuperDuper. I didn't know that. I've been using it for years and I never knew they were there. Okay, so we worked back and forth through email for a week or two, and finally we scheduled a play date to work on it. Of course, we went to the gym first and then out to lunch, but then we buckled down and got back to work. It was so much fun watching her work, doing things I dream of being able to do. I think if I get to retire, I'd like to learn how to do AppleScript. It looks like so much fun. We worked away for a couple of hours, and in the end, Dorothy was successful. Well, she was almost done. When she left, we could launch the automated workflow she created. It would mount the Drobo, mount the disk image, run the backup, and put it all away. It even had an audible message at the start that tells me that the Drobo has successfully mounted, and when it's done, it says, happy, happy, joy, joy, in this very mechanical voice. But one thing was missing. She didn't know how to make it run on its own as a timed event. Remember, I want it to run automatically at a specific time. We were both pretty sure that one does this sort of thing with a cron job, which is a Unix term for a job that runs scheduled executions of scripts, programs, or applications. It was clear we needed a production assistant, so we brought Bart on as a consultant. He told us about an awesome application called Chronix from code.google.com/p/Chronix. Chronix is spelled C-R-O-N-N-I-X with a capital X, and it's free and open source, licensed under the GPL3. A quick download of Chronix, and we had a tool that was so simple to use, even I could figure it out. Okay, technically Dorothy figured it out, but after she explained it to me, I totally had it figured out. With Chronix, you see a place to enter the minutes and hour you want your script or application to run, and then the day of the month and the month. If you want it to run every day, you just leave a star in all those fields that, the month and that sort of thing. Likewise, you see the days of the week as options to define or leave every day. I may have actually figured out one thing on my own. You can set up more than one cron job using Chronix. So I set one to run at 5:30 a.m. every day of the week, Monday through Friday. Remember that springing me out of bed thing? Well, since that's only Monday through Friday, I set the second one to run on Saturday and Sunday, but at the lazy bones hour of 10 after 7. Steve says I'm a slacker that I sleep in until 7 on weekends. Seriously, he's been up for like more than an hour when he drags me out of bed at 7. I think 7 is obscene on a Saturday, but that's my cross to bear. So anyway, this isn't about what a nut job my husband is about getting up early. It's about the script and cron and all that. I love Chronix. I love the simplicity of the interface, and I love how I can actually control this myself without having to learn any Unix commands. So now I wake up, flip open the laptop, and a few minutes later I hear Alex's voice telling me how wonderful my backups are going. It's awesome. So the next day I told Dorothy to get started working on a podcast production script for me.
Ha ha ha.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I?
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
So a gentleman who prefers to be referred to as Horse wrote in with his dumb question. Hi, Allison. Hopefully you see this as a dumb question. Surely I should know this. iCloud is now here and is incredibly useful and innovative, and I really want to use it. But how secure is iCloud? I heard Bart mention that, quite rightly, he now encrypts everything on his Macs, but I cannot find anywhere the definitive answer to the question. Are my contacts, calendar, and data encrypted in the iCloud? If it is encrypted, where is the encryption done, and using what key? Is it in the device before it's sent to the cloud? Is it encrypted at the cloud and then decrypted to be sent back to a device? If it's not encrypted, why not? And is it really safe to put my info up there if that is the case? Well, there you are. Either the question's dumb or I'm dumb. I will leave it to you to decide. Well, Horse, of course you're not dumb. Anybody who doesn't ask questions is the one who's dumb. That's always been something I prescribe to. Well, I didn't find this on my own, but I got you a very good answer. I first searched on the Apple support pages and got no hits at all using the term iCloud encryption, which I'm assuming you probably tried yourself. Then I tried the forums, but they were offline when I tried. In frustration, I put a screenshot of the down for maintenance screen in Twitter. Then Patrick Kennebry said, "So what you looking for? Maybe I can help." I gave him your question, and he found the support article that explains in detail what's encrypted and where. It's actually Apple support article HT4865, and it says the following content is encrypted using SSL when sent over the internet to or from iCloud. So what's encrypted is photos in your photo stream, documents in the cloud, backup data for your iOS device, mail, contact, calendars, bookmarks, reminders, notes, location requests and data for Find My iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch, and Mac, location requests and data for Find My Friends, music and iTunes Match, data access using Back to My Mac, and content access using the web applications at iCloud.com. Then it describes what encryption content is stored in the cloud, the use of secure tokens for authentication, and iCloud privacy. So the article is actually quite long, and I put a link in the show notes to it. And it sounds like it is pretty well encrypted. I'm not an expert in this field, as I've established over the years, but I just wanted to tell you that I think you're probably in good shape. And thank you very much to Patrick for helping us find the answer. Sometimes it takes a village. This week, I have been working on an epic Screen Steps document. At work, we have to create these user acceptance test documents for users to follow to confirm that the software we've written or are putting in place functions as it should. We're not allowed to go live without going through user acceptance testing. So I've gone through this test site, and I use Screen Steps to write a 122-page user acceptance test manual. It is so awesome. It's got lots of pictures, of course, but I may have gone a little bit out of control there. I decided to try out the export to Word function you get with Screen Steps Pro for the very first time. The standard formats are really beautiful, actually, but if you need, you can edit the templates to your own liking. But one thing confused me. The table of contents didn't show up like it does in the PDF export. I headed on over to the Blue Mango Learning website, figuring I'd poke around for a bit, and then I'd just bother Trevor and Greg, the developers. But who do you think has the best documentation in the world about how to use their software? Well, the Screen Steps guys, of course. I typed into the search field on the documentation page, Word table of contents, and boom, right there was a lovely three-step Screen Steps tutorial showing me how to right-click on the table of contents, and bada-bing, bada-boom, the table of contents showed up. Oh, another indicator that I might have overdone it on my test document? That table of contents was 5.5 pages long. I bet nobody's going to do this testing. It's going to be great. I'm not going to get any failures at all. So if you need to create great documentation, explain how to use a piece of software, or even just send instructions to someone in your family or your friends, you can't do better than Screen Steps or Clarify from BlueMangoLearning.com. Learn from these guys. I mean, go look at their site and think about how many fewer help support calls you would have if you use Screen Steps to document your software. And by the way, be sure to tell them that Allison sent you.
Hi, Allison and fellow Nissilla Castaways. This is Rod Simmons from Simple Mobile Review. This is going to be our pick for a stocking stuffer or Secret Santa type gift that you might do at your office or with family and friends. But before I just tell you what the product is, let me give you the little scenario of the problem we're going to solve. So imagine that you're sitting in the car with a work colleague. You both are looking at your phones and realize they both need a charge. And then you look at the single cigarette lighter adapter in the front of the car and think, it's almost like the Old West. Who can get their charger out fast enough to plug it into the adapter wins? Or you might find out that the owner of the car realizes that, no, dude, I win. Or the person who rented the car says, yeah, you can wait till later. Now, we're also going to assume that no one has taken the recommendation to get like an iSound or an XPAL 1800 or any of those other chargers, USB chargers, solar chargers that we've recommended before in the past. So let's get to what the product is. It's called the Griffin PowerJolt Dual Universal USB Adapter. What it does is it mounts into the USB adapter, and it has two USB ports. So you can take your iPhone cable or iPod cable, plug it in, and you could take your Android cable, micro USB cable, plug that in, or it might be any other type of USB cable, and both devices can sit happily in charge. Now, the reason why I like this is because it allows you to take something that you already have in your car and share it with others. Most of us travel around with at least one iPhone or one micro USB cable in our bag, so it's not a big deal when someone says you can charge, just plug in here, and it's just a USB port. And that's what I like about this. Now, more importantly, what I really like about this is that it gives you a flush mount around the cigarette lighter adapter. So where a lot of traditional car chargers, they kind of stick out a long ways, so they kind of might get in the way of other things. This mounts nice, tight, and flush in as if it were a cigarette lighter adapter with kind of the top of it cut off. Now, the problem with that is if you're in a rental car, I always make sure with mine that after I plug it in and I charge, before I get out of the rental car, I unplug it and put it back in my bag because let's just say that I've lost a couple in rental cars over the last bit, and I've learned that because it's so flush mounted, you almost forget that it's there, which is in part the beauty of it. So in my personal car, I actually just have this and it sits inside of there. But when I go and I keep one in my bag for when I go in rental cars, I make sure that I remove it in and out. It's a very inexpensive item. It's Amazon Prime eligible, so if you guys are smart enough to sign up for Amazon Prime, you can get the item for $8.81 with free shipping. And that, for me, is key with Amazon, especially with an item this inexpensive. So if you're looking for a decent stocking stuffer idea, everyone can always use another way to charge, and nothing is better than having something with two ports. I would also say that for someone like Allison, who actually carries around a BlackBerry and an iPhone, if she finds that both devices need to charge while she's on her way to work, she can just pull out her micro USB cable for a BlackBerry, charge the 9300 I think she has, charge that sucker up, and then she can also pull out her iPod cable and charge that up. Now, of course, Allison will tell you she charges her iPhone every night. She never has battery issues, but just in case you're in need of power, this would be a good recommendation.
Thanks, Rod. This looks pretty cool. I wonder if it's hard to pry it out because it's flush there. I bought one a while back that only had one port, but I had a heck of a time pulling it out because it was one of those flush mount ones. This one must work better if you've been pulling it in and out of rental cars all this time, so I'm guessing it's a good one. By the way, the Griffin Power Jolt has dropped in price since Rod did the review. It's only $6.75 as of this recording. I should mention also that the iDot Sound Rod mentions, which was one of the very first reviews he did for us, that thing has been a godsend to me. When I was down with my mom for 3 days, I stayed at my brother's house. Instead of carrying three power blocks for my iPhone, my iPad, my BlackBerry 9300, and hunting around the house for open power ports, all I carried with me was the iDot Sound. I didn't even bring its power brick. I knew that it would carry me for a few days charging all of these devices over and over again. And with four available USB ports, I didn't have to worry about swapping devices in and out. I usually travel with the cables anyway, so it was just a matter of throwing that iDot Sound in the bag and making sure it was charged before I left, and I was fine. By the time I came home 3 days later, it actually still had some juice left. Not much, but a little bit. Let's change gears a little bit and let's hear a review from Steve Davidson.
UPSs are a real butt saver. Before I go any further, I should explain what UPSs are. UPS is an acronym for Uninterruptible Power Supply. The typical consumer UPS looks like a big fat power strip. They usually have a row or two of wall power plugs, and inside they have control circuitry and a sealed lead-acid battery, like the kind used for emergency lights in schools and public buildings that turn on when the power fails. The main purpose of a UPS is to ensure that when there's an electric power failure, your sensitive electronic devices don't even notice. The power supply is uninterrupted. In effect, by using a UPS, your computers, servers, network equipment, DVR, whatever, can coast through short power outages, and that's the problem to be solved. There is actually a lot more to UPSs than that. Good UPSs contain circuitry that regulate the power so that when the electric company has problems and the juice goes a bit low or high, the output of the UPS stays constant. This can significantly increase the lifetime of electronic devices. They also provide better lightning strike protection than surge suppressors, although nothing can protect you against a direct strike. And they may contain protection for Ethernet and cable TV inputs, because there are other ways for power spikes to get into your sensitive electronics. I not only use UPSs to protect my wife's iMac, I also use a different UPS to protect my router and network-attached storage, and a different UPS to let my TiVo, which really is a computer in disguise, coast through short electric outages. At this point, you're probably wondering what constitutes a short electric outage. The answer depends on how much power your devices draw and the storage capacity of the UPS. As you might imagine, UPSs come in different capacities, often measured in VA units. A good rule of thumb is that the wattage equivalent for a computer is 60% of the VA. If your device, for example, draws a maximum of 200 watts, like a 21-inch iMac, then the maximum safe rating of the UPS would need to be 333 VA. But that's a sustainment level. A higher rated UPS will give you the ability to stay up for a period of time during a power failure. For example, that 21-inch iMac will stay up for at least 10 minutes with a 550 VA UPS, 12 minutes with a 650 VA, and 14 minutes with a 750 VA UPS. Note that the wattage specified for a computer is the maximum, with screen brightness at peak, CPU hammering away, and lots of disk read-write. Normal operations should be much lower than the maximum rating, and that'll result in longer UPS uptime. I've included a link in the show notes to a web page which calculates the uptime based on device wattage for a particular brand of UPS that I use at home. The Backups ES series made by American Power Conversion, or APC. I should mention that the Backup ES 550 I use on my wife's iMac can be had for under $60 US at Amazon.com, and the more hefty 750VA model is available for $85. And be sure to use the affiliates link at podfeet.com. These UPSs come with a really important feature, a cable that connects to the USB port on your computer. This tells your computer the status of the UPS, including when it's operating on battery power, how much power is left, etc. Apple has built-in support for UPSs in the Mac OS. The Energy Saver System Preference will detect the attached UPS and provide a number of features such as a menu bar status indicator and a separate set of controls for screen dim and sleep. In addition, you can set shutdown options to shut the computer down when, for example, there's only 4 minutes left of life in the battery. This enables unattended shutdown for your computers. An unanticipated benefit of my UPS revealed itself a little over a month ago. You might remember that a monster early snowstorm clobbered the northeastern part of the United States, knocking down trees and causing massive power outages. As soon as the lights went off, I shut down all my UPS-protected equipment and then shut down my UPSs. This gave me the stored equivalent of wall power on demand. We were in darkness for a while, and I was able to keep phones, iOS devices, and my son's MacBook charged by periodically plugging them into and turning on one or another of my UPSs. Under conditions like that, my UPSs really were a butt saver. So long, Allison, until I think of something else to submit. This is Steve Davidson.
You know, Steve, this is one of those things that I think about doing, and I never get around to doing it. I guess the fact that I live in an area where we don't have big snowstorms or thunderstorms kind of makes me cocky. We do have the occasional power glitch from time to time, but we haven't suffered long-term, and none of those have resulted in catastrophic failure of a device. But then again, we do live in the area of earthquakes, so maybe it would be a good idea. These prices sure make it seem compelling to get off my butt and actually get some UPSs.
Hi, Allison, and the NoSilicast listeners out there. Jane from Perth here. Apple has recently encouraged us to convert from our Mobile Me accounts to iCloud. The changeover to iCloud has gone well for me, but I know others have suffered quite a few problems. One issue that I did have was finding out that sharing address books between iCloud users was no longer as simple as it was with Mobile Me accounts. Prior to iCloud, you could just choose to subscribe with an address book to another Mobile Me user's address book, allowing access to their contacts. This was how we shared our contacts in my household. I hosted the main address book on my computer, which synced nicely across my machines and iOS devices by Mobile Me, and my husband, John, would subscribe to my address book, thereby populating his address book with all of my contacts. It was only after the changeover to iCloud that I noticed that John's iMac wasn't updating with contacts that I added to my address book, and so it became apparent that subscribing no longer worked between iCloud accounts. But fear not, the same result can still be achieved with iCloud. It just takes a slightly more convoluted method. Firstly, there's a point I need to make clear, and that is, this sharing method involves allowing access to the host's iCloud account on the client's computer. So you need to make sure you trust the person with whom you will be sharing your iCloud account. So, how do we achieve the sharing of address book contacts? As I said earlier, I host the main address book for our household on my iMac, and this syncs neatly across my Mac and iOS devices via iCloud. That's the simple bit. Now, onto John's iMac. On his machine, I create a new iCloud account using my iCloud credentials. This new account is recognized by his machine as not being the primary iCloud account on his Mac. He still has his own existing iCloud account showing his mail, contacts, calendars, bookmarks, photo stream, and so on. The new iCloud account gives access to my mail and notes, contacts and calendars. So, as I only want my contacts on his machine, I ensure the contacts option is ticked and I deselect the mail and calendar options. I then go to John's primary iCloud account and deselect contacts in there, leaving all his other iCloud options as they were. And lo and behold, my contacts now show up in his address book. I use the same procedure on his iPhone to give him sharing access to my contacts there as well, by creating a new iCloud account with my credentials, again selecting only contacts. He now has read and write access to my contacts, which we use as the main address book. Any additions or alterations show up immediately across all of our synced devices, keeping us both in perfect harmony. There may be a few hiccups to this method, one being that contacts don't appear in John's primary iCloud address book on the web interface, but as he doesn't use that, it's not a problem for him. Also, he could continue to run his own address book contacts in tandem with our main address book by selecting contacts in his primary iCloud account. If you would like to see the full steps I used to achieve our sharing of address books, then take a peek at my website at maxstrings.com. I'm sure Alison will be good enough to put the link into this week's show notes. Let it snow. Cheers, guys, and season's greetings to you all.
Well, first of all, Jane, I'm thrilled to have you back on the show. It's been such a long time, and I love your reviews. I hope you'll keep coming back. Secondly, this is a fantastic tip. Steve and I never have kept our contacts in sync. I just assumed that couldn't be done. I never even tried. I just usually export all my V cards every once in a while, and then I write over everything he has, since I'm the keeper of the data. I'll have to float this idea with him, but I bet he'd love to have this synced up at all times. You can find Jane, by the way, on Twitter at Jane73 or at her website at maxstrings.com. While I was doing the live show, Kirshen told me about a super fun new feature of Text Expander. I've told you a few times about how much time Text Expander saves me, and it just makes me really happy to look at my statistics. I reset my Text Expander stats in January, and now, 11 months later, I've expanded 8,918 snippets, saving 218,000 keystrokes. Seriously, 218,000 keystrokes in a year. That's crazy. If I typed 60 words a minute, which might be exaggerating a little bit, but I like to think I type that fast, that would mean that I've saved over 12 hours of typing. All right, here's the super fun new feature in Text Expander that Kirshen told us about. You can tweet your stats. How fun is that? All right, so maybe I'll start to really annoy people if I do it too often, so I better be judicious on doing this, but I still think it's fun to brag about. It'd be fun to see what other people tweet back. If you'd like to save hundreds of thousands of keystrokes, and you know I'm not exaggerating because I got the stats right there, if you want to save all those hundreds of thousands of keystrokes, check out Text Expander from smilesoftware.com. And be sure to tell them that you heard about it on the NoSillaCast. Hey, I'm up to 8,928 snippets expanded now. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz. How are you this lovely, fall, autumnal day?
I think we're gone beyond autumnal
now. Are we wintered
now?
Yet?
Well, I was along the canal today because the Santa special trains were running, which in itself says it's nearly Christmas time, and there was ice on the canal.
Ah, ice.
Not much, but enough to make me go, it's bloody cold today.
Well, I was up at 5:30 in the morning to go look at the lunar eclipse with Steve, which was really fun. We went down to the beach, and unfortunately, it was supposed to be a total eclipse right at 6:45 when it was supposed to hit the ocean, but the haze was so bad that we really couldn't see it very well once we got to the beach. But luckily, we got a couple of good shots before we left.
It was setting, was it?
Yeah, it was setting. And the odd thing about where we were was even though the sun and the moon are 12 or exactly 180 degrees apart at the lunar eclipse, because of the refraction from the horizons, you were supposed to be able to see them both at the same time.
if you had a very flat horizon. Imagine if you're in the middle of, you know, the prairie or something, that would have worked.
Yeah, it didn't work here.
Yeah, because you have mountainy stuff on the other side of you when you have sea on one side, don't you?
And just a little hill is enough to make it obscure it.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah.
So but did you get any photos?
Yeah, we got a couple of good photos before we left. Steve got one before I woke up with it about a quarter gone, and then I got one good shot of it about three quarters, and then I just took artsy-fartsy pictures
of the beach. Does it give you an idea how far apart we are physically in the world?
Yeah.
So you were getting the eclipse setting as it was going into eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Ireland, it was rising as it was coming out of eclipse.
Wow.
Although it was cloudy, so I saw nothing.
Again, who would have thought, right?
Exactly. But anyway, so there we go.
All right. Well, we're having trouble staying focused. It took us almost an hour to get started so far. So
wait,
better...
no, half an hour, Alison, half an hour.
Half an hour? You sure?
Yeah, we started at half past, not at...
Oh, who
we've
knows?
Only wasted half an hour.
I think it was a waste. We had a lot of fun. Actually, we diagnosed Skype problems, so it was a good effort. The peaking that I had last week, Bart helped me get rid of, so that's good.
So quality is hopefully better.
Anywho, let's start out with Security Light, Bart. What's up this week?
Next week is Patch Tuesday.
Oh, yay!
So there are 14 bulletins, and they contain critical patches for all versions of Windows and many versions of Office. I don't actually know what all versions of Office exist, so I'm not sure if it's actually all versions or just many versions.
Okay. Does it affect OS X versions?
I find it very hard to read that TechNet piece on Office, but the link is in the show notes. Let me see.
I'm sure we'll get a notice if it is.
We will get a notice if it is. Affected software. See,
let's see.
The Windows matrix always looks nice, but the Office matrix is such a mess.
Oh, there we go. 2004, 2008, and 2011. Bulletin.
Okay,
bulletin
one of them is
five.
Three of them are important, and most of them are not applicable. So, yes, we do have updates.
But if you have 2011, it's only bulletin five that will affect you. But enough to say, run the update.
Yeah, and if you have 2008, then you only have to worry about bulletin 8. And if you have 2004, you only have to worry about bulletin 10. So there's a different bulletin to worry about, but there's one for everyone.
That's nice. All right, so I guess we should watch for an update next week then.
We should, and wake up all those VMs, yada, yada, yada. Okay. Usual stuff. And then, of course, it is a day ending in a Y. Therefore, we have an Adobe issue. This one's nasty, actually. This one's very nasty. So this is a zero-day vulnerability, as in it is a vulnerability for which there is no patch, which is being actively exploited in the wild.
Oof.
Now, there's some slight good news. So with version 10 of Acrobat and Reader, what Adobe did was they implemented a sort of inside-app sandboxing, effectively, to try to limit the damage that a runaway PDF could do to your system. And the good news is that in version 10, the bug exists, but it can't be exploited because the in-app sandboxing nubbles it. But people who are running version 9 or earlier have a problem. And it's a very real problem that's being actually used by actual bad guys right now, this instant. So if you're using version 9, Adobe have promised they'll rush out a patch for you on the week starting the 12th of December, which is next week. But they haven't said exactly when, and it's just sort of a best attempt. So my advice would be, unless you have a really good reason to stay on 9, that you should move to 10, or better still, just get rid of it. Just make it go away.
So how long has 10 been out? It's been out for a while?
10's been out for a good while, yeah.
Okay, good. Because had to install it. We got a letter. My credit card got defrauded, and we needed to do an affidavit, and they kept being too lame to physically mail it to me, even though they kept claiming they were going to do it. And Steve finally got them to email it, and it was emailed in a format that could only be opened with Acrobat.
Using encryption or requiring you to type stuff in or something like that?
It was some encryption stuff, and it was a weird form that when you finished it and hit save, it automatically sent it back to them.
It had embedded script. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can actually embed flash code inside PDFs.
Yeah, it was
which
weird.
Is one of those things that makes me very, very, very scared. It's like a vulnerability within a vulnerability, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, exactly.
So there are times that you indeed do need the Adobe stuff, but if you must rerun it, be sure you're running version 10, because otherwise you can't protect yourself until this update comes out.
Right. I will make
and
sure
And consider just getting rid of it. Then finally, just a reminder to people. We told you a few weeks ago that there was a Java update, and I'm sure we told you to do it, but now I'm telling you that if you haven't done it, really, really do it very, 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 very quickly. because the bad guys have started using this one in anger. It's a particularly nasty vulnerability because it is entirely cross-platform. So it means that using the same exploit, you can hack Windows, Linux, and Mac machines. And there is a working module for it in Metasploit, which means that the good guys can test and the bad guys have the code too. So there are already, it's already being sold on the black market, and it's been added into some of these. You can actually buy hacking kits.
Oh, nice.
Actually, you hand over money to, I presume there's some Russian mafia types or something like that, but you basically buy yourself some malware. And then, you know, so you buy the malware and then you make your own payload and then away you go. And it is in those malware kits and it is in Metasploit. So this is out there and it is nasty.
So remind us again, how do you update Java?
If you're on iOS 10, it should come in through software update. You should say, I'd like to update Java. And you should say, yes, you should. Okay. If you're on Windows, you should find that sitting in your that little tray thingy on the right-hand side of the start bar at the bottom. Taskbar, I think it's called. Uh-huh. There should be a little Java icon in there looking for your attention. Give it said
say
attention.
Yes.
Say yes, exactly.
Okay.
And if you're on Linux, it depends on what distro you're on. And if you're on Linux, you should know how to do that.
Right. Okay.
So that's Security Lite.
Good. All right. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. But I'm glad we have stuff we can do. So what's our main topic here?
Well, our main topic is sort of, it's what I've been waiting to do for a while, but I had to wait for something to happen. So we talked a while ago about my digital spring clean and sort of my plans to not replace my laptop. So a while ago, I was asked if I would give a presentation to our local astronomy society in the university. And I said I would. And then I thought to myself, this is an interesting test because one of the functions my laptop has performed for all the many years I've owned it is that it is the tool I use to give presentations. So if my plan is to not replace said laptop, I should really have a go at seeing what it's like to do a presentation without a laptop.
Yikes.
So I figured I'm going to do this one iPad only. And I did. And it worked. This is the good side. So this story has a happy ending, which is nice.
Let me ask you, did you have it on a thumb drive just in case?
Oh, I did.
Yeah, okay.
And I had it on iWork.com, and I had it in my Dropbox.
Okay, good.
So as a PPT, as well as a .key file.
Right.
So if the worst came to the worst, I would be using the PC that is built into the little cabinet thingy in the lecture theater, and I would be browsing to my Dropbox and getting the PowerPoint version of the file. I was always going to get there, no matter what happened.
You had a belt, suspenders, a rope.
Oh, yeah.
And a spare pair of pants on underneath.
And I'd stapled my trousers up while I was at it. I mean, much fallback.
So you're not a fool then.
Thankfully, I needed none of my safety nets.
Okay.
So that's the good news. So I had sort of been looking for an excuse to anyway. So I bought the little Yoki that turns an iPad or an iPhone connector into a VGA connector.
Right.
Which is €29.99. So I imagine it's similar priced in dollars.
Yeah.
And then I obviously had to pick up a version of Keynote on iOS, which was €7.99, which I guess is probably $10 in the States.
Such a nice price.
It's a good price. Yeah, I like it.
It's
a full-featured app. So that was all the expenses I had to do, and they were sort of things I'd been planning to do anyway. And compared to the price of a new laptop, definitely cheaper.
Yeah.
So I didn't like, I don't find it comfortable to create presentations on the mobile version of Keynote. Yes, you can do it, and the more graphical the presentation, the better it works. But the more texty the presentation, the less I like it. So I wanted to continue to create my presentations on the Mac as I've done for years, but to present them on the iPad.
Now, are you a fan in general of Keynote?
I am. I'm a huge fan of Keynote. It can still be abused like PowerPoint can be abused, but give me Keynote over PowerPoint any day.
Okay.
You don't agree?
I can't stand Keynote.
Can you stand it more or less than you can stand PowerPoint? Because I know you can't stand PowerPoint either.
So my objection to PowerPoint is that you spend an inordinate amount of your time screwing around with formatting instead of creating content. So when I want to create a presentation, I grab a bunch of scratch paper out of the recycle bin and I draw out what I want to say. And I write my bullets on scratch paper. And then when I'm done, I sit down and type it. But what I find is people spend hours going, well, if I remove this one word, that'll make this row one line shorter, which will bring that last sentence onto the page without shrinking the font down to 12 point or something, you know. And that's not valuable to the end customer. You know, you're not generating revenue when you're doing that. You're wasting time. So that's my main objection. From a usability standpoint, though, I think I still prefer the new PowerPoint to Keynote. And it's things like the last presentation I did in Keynote, I put a bunch of boxes on screen that were going to come up one at a time, and they were all pretty animated and stuff. And then I realized, I said, you know what, rounded corners, because Steve Jobs loves rounded corners would look better than square corners. I had to delete every box and change it one by one. I couldn't say, let me check, select all these, change the shape. That's stupid. Okay. That's just stupid.
That is stupid, but... I certainly find that for sort of, you know, regular presentations with text and pictures and maybe some video, I find that Keynote is a really, really pleasant experience.
So then the very last time I did a Keynote was when Adam and I were speaking at Blogworld. I wanted one page. I wanted it to say the name of our talk, each of our names and our Twitter handles and the name of our podcast or whatever, something like that. It was going to be like 5 lines long. And I found this really pretty little format. It was a title page. It had a little squirrely thing in the middle. And I thought, well, I like that little squirrely thing because it kind of separated the text, looked really cool, but I needed to move it. I had to go to Twitter to find out how to move it. It was somehow locked to the page. It wasn't in the format. It wasn't in the slide master where I could get rid of it or move it. It was, it's just like, really? It
was probably part of the background image, was it?
No, it actually was something you could unlock, but it wasn't, you know, I'm used to just being able to go to the slide master and it should be there and be movable at that point, and it wasn't.
I have to say, the only things I ever use is either the standard themes, and I use very simple ones. I like chalkboard. It's one of
my
best.
Yeah.
And I think I made up my own theme once where I used a starry background, and then I decided that was way too much like effort. And I just use chalkboard for everything. And I just type in my stuff, and then if it doesn't fit on the screen, I hit Command A, Command Minus, Command Minus, Command Minus until it fits. And that's all I do.
I do find I spend a lot of time getting things to live on the page.
I don't do that until the very end, though. I write the whole presentation, and I don't care whether or not it fits.
Okay, but
and then I go back through and I say, okay, so what's overflowing? And then
okay,
I say,
but the part where it doesn't fit,
pages?
I can't see it when it doesn't fit. On Keynote, it doesn't go off the bottom of the page. It disappears.
Yeah, but you see, I just stick it in outline view when I'm writing.
Okay.
Wait. Yeah, I just stick it in outline view, and then I can see everything, whether it fits on the page
maybe
or not.
Maybe that's the way to go.
Right away.
That's
yeah, so I just do my outline,
idea.
And that's what you do on paper.
I don't even know where outline view is. But
View, there's a drop-down menu called View in the toolbar, and I just say outline.
That's a good idea. Yeah, that would probably speed me up. Stop looking at the the image until you're done. Yeah.
Yeah, and then so once you're happy with the content, then I spend 10 minutes maybe making it look pretty. And then sometimes if I'm doing a quotation from something, I might change the font on the quotation to make it stand out, but that's sort of about as advanced as I get.
Okay.
So yeah, I guess maybe I'm just very minimalist, and that's maybe it's designed for minimalist people. Which, if Steve Jobs had anything to do with it, that kind of makes sense.
I'm just trying to start half the time. But anyway, I didn't want to make it a whole thing about how much I hated that. But I will show you the when we're done, we'll go offline. I'll show you the one that didn't work and just like, okay, you show me how you would do that.
Well, I would just go to Blackboard. I do everything in Blackboard, seriously.
What's Blackboard?
It's the theme. I just use the theme Blackboard.
Chalkboard.
It's called. And that's all I do. Uh-huh. I don't care. So anyway, so I wrote it on my Mac, but of course... Because iLife on the Mac is old, it's iLife 09 is the latest version, it's really quite out of touch with sort of modernity. And that has two effects, and the first of those effects is that when you write a presentation on the Mac and you stick it on the iPad, it's not guaranteed to work.
Yeah, because that's another thing I hate about Keynote.
Yeah, because the two versions are just so far apart in time that they don't really work together well. And I am assuming that Apple are working on a new version of iWork, which will marry beautifully between iOS and the Mac. But for now, we're left sort of with a hacky solution where we have the old version on the Mac and a new version on the iPad. And they don't really live very happily together. But thankfully, Apple have created a support document with the lovely short and snappy title, Keynote for iPad : Best Practices for Creating a Presentation on the Mac for Use on an iPad. Thankfully, the actual
document wrote documentation instead of good software.
Yeah, now thankfully, though, I mean, I'm really happy they wrote this because they basically tell you, look, if you want this to go smoothly, here are your simple hints. Huh. You use the following themes and the following themes only. You set the size to 1024x768, and the only masters you should use are this subset of masters, and there's about 10 of them there.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it just gives you little hints of things to do and things not to do. Huh. How do you deal with images and so forth? And following those instructions, it was seamless. But before I went and looked for those instructions, I just said, before I start this, I'm going to pick a random presentation from my past, stick it on the iPad and see what happens. Mm-hmm. What happens is that you get a whole bunch of conversion errors and or warnings. That's what happens. But once I follow those guidelines, what happened is I just got one little warning where it basically swapped one font for another font, and it was a font that seems to be identically sized because no formatting was broke at all. And it was visually, it was in keeping with the theme. And basically, it was just a very subtle difference of one type of handwriting to another type of handwriting.
Oh, that's nice.
So, that was it. And it was just a warning, and it didn't break anything. So, you know, by following those instructions, I ended up with a very smooth experience. But by taking a random presentation, I ended up with a very icky experience.
Now, I had trouble where just I didn't get a lot of errors, but I got things didn't fit on the page the way they did when they were in Keynote on the Mac.
I got none of that by sticking to those guidelines.
I should say that was probably 2 years ago, so it's possible it's gotten better.
Well, the iOS version of Keynote has had quite a few iterations.
Right.
At this stage. But, yeah, I followed the guidelines, and I had none of that kind of stuff. And what I was expecting my workflow to be was I would write it on the Mac, and I would make it look okay. I would bring it over to the iPad, and then I would tweak it. Mm-hmm. There was no need for tweaking. It was fine.
Oh, good, good.
Which, as I say, it surprised me. And I had videos in there, and they were fine. I had images in there, and they were fine.
Wow. Did the videos transport over as part of the Keynote, or are they a separate, like an attachment file?
No, they came in as part of the Keynote, so it was a fairly chunky Keynote at 18 megabytes. But, yeah, they came over. So it was just one file, and it came over. So I was pleasantly surprised. So then the next step, of course, so I've written the presentation, and I've got to get it onto the iPad. And this is where we hit the second major limitation, is that iWork 09 does not have any support for iCloud. So you have this notion of iCloud promising
Wait,
us this wonderful
really?
Seamless... Yeah, really.
I hadn't tried that yet.
You obviously weren't watching my Twitter feed when I discovered that little reality.
Were you saying some non-Girl Scout safe words again, Bart?
Oh, yeah. I was most cranky. I mean... Actually, no, it was on the Mac Roundtable where Don was like, it's fine. I'm sure they'll get round to it eventually. And I was like, I'm sorry, Steve lied to us. I just thought it was disgraceful that they were talking about document syncing and all its promises and making it out. Oh, you just write a presentation here and you can get it from anywhere. And they never mentioned the fact that this wouldn't work on the Mac. I felt it was false trade description. I just felt they didn't actually lie to us. If you go back and listen, they choose their words really carefully. So they didn't lie, but I would count it as a lie by omission. I was just not impressed. I felt that the impression they gave and the reality they delivered did not tally.
Yeah, what good is...
There is a hack, right? It is, you can do it, but it's not straightforward. So the officially supported way of doing it is that you open up Safari, you go to iWork or iCloud.com, you log in, you go to the Documents in the Cloud tab, and then you drag and drop your Keynote presentation onto your browser window.
Oh,
and then
really?
It will upload it.
Huh.
And it does work. That works. So it uploads. Although I found a bug, which I seem to be good at. So I would drag and drop it up. It's an 18 meg file. I have pretty crappy broadband when it comes to upload speeds. It's very, very strongly ADSL, as in asynchronous. So I would drop it up, and it would go for about 5 minutes and get to sometimes 3 megabytes. One time it even got to 11 megabytes.
Just to give you hope.
Yeah, and then it would die. And I did this, I would say, at least 6 times. And I was getting there was steam coming out of my ears.
Oh, I can't.
And then I realized that I had iWork, or not I, I had Keynote open on my iPad. So I closed it, did it again, and it worked first time.
Oh, interesting.
So it seemed that the iPad going over to check, is there a new file, was causing it to somehow think it had finished uploading, and then it was going, it's a corrupted file.
Huh.
And so that made it cranky. But by turning off... any sort of Keynote-y thing on any of my iOS devices, the problem went away. But this still is still, I mean, it's still a hacky solution, because if you make a change in your iPad, then you have to download it to your Mac again, and then you have to upload it again. I mean, it's all the kind of horrible, horrible things that made iCloud a necessity. So hopefully, if they don't fix this in the next version of iWork, I'm going to be very cranky again. But anyway, so using that web interface solution, in inverted commas, it did go up eventually. And once it's up, it's actually quite straightforward. So you just, you go into, I mean, I had it on my iPhone and I had it on my iPad. And you just go in and it notices there's a new file and you see it downloading the file and then you're ready to go. What I would say is this doesn't download in the background. So don't edit your slides at the last second. Upload them to iWork and then leave the house. Right? You open
don't
up.
Touch it.
Well, no, you open up, you go to your iPad afterwards, you upload it, then you go to your iPad, and then you let it download before you leave the house. Because what if there's no Wi-Fi where you're going?
Oh, so right. Sorry, it took sure a minute that for that to sink in,
You got to be sure the presentation gets synced to the actual iPad properly before you leave. So I did that, and the other thing I found is on the first-gen iPad, the Keynote app is fairly heavy. It's a clunky, it's a great big app, and it seems to take a lot of RAM and stuff. So I think what happens is when I launch it, it goes and kills 20 million other processes to make room. And so it takes an annoyingly long time to load up, so I like to do it before I leave the house. And then when I get there, I have the presentation loaded and sitting on the first page.
Right.
It's just easy that way.
Yeah, yeah.
What I also did then, belt and suspenders, so I stuck it onto Dropbox. And from in the Dropbox app on iOS, you can send it to Keynote, so that's fine. And I stuck it up on iWork.com, which had the bizarre effect of turning my 18 megabyte presentation into a 75 megabyte presentation. Which I think is because it converts it to PPT and PDF as well before updating. And I think the PPT version is much bigger than the Keynote version.
Oh, interesting. So it's less efficient?
It seems to be. So it went from 18 up to 75 megs, which made me slightly cranky because that was a big upload for me.
Huge difference.
Yeah. And then obviously I had the PPT on my thumb drive. So, I mean, you know, I was able to work on the Mac and get it onto the iPad, and that was fine. So then when I actually came to give the presentation, I was kind of really kind of happy with the iOS version of Keynote. So it just, basically, it just works. So you take your little dongle you bought, you plug it into the VGA, and that's all you have to do, and then it just knows that there's a VGA projector there. But at first glance, you might think it hasn't worked, because very sensibly, what it does before you hit play is it shows nothing on the screen, which is actually what you want, because while you're prepping, you don't want everyone seeing what you're doing. You only want it to go onto the projector when you're ready to go.
So it waits until you hit slideshow, right?
So it waits until you hit slideshow, but of course, me didn't think of that logicalness, and so I plugged it in and went, oh my god, it doesn't work. And then I went, wait a second, what if I hit this play button? So, phew, okay, there we go, that works, thank goodness for that. Although between then, what I had done is I'd quit the app and restarted the app, saying, what if it needs to be plugged in before I start the app? No, it doesn't, it just works. But bear that in mind, it will put out a black screen. And the reason I noticed is because when the projector is warming up, it puts out a blue screen when it has no input, and I was getting a black screen, which is because the iPad was successfully putting out all black.
Yeah, isn't there some way to have it show you, like, the notes pages on the iPad while the thing is projected on
the screen?
Yes,
so that's the presenter display. So once you hit play, you get into this dual mode where the projector gets your slides, as makes sense, and you then get the presenter screen on the iPad or the iPhone. And the presenter screen gives you the options to either just see the current slide, to see the current slide plus your presenter notes, or to see the current slide and the next slide. And actually, I prefer the current slide and next slide because I don't believe in these presenter note thingies.
Mm-hmm.
So I never have any. So there's no point in me showing them. And by always being able to see what's coming next, it actually really helps you not to make say things like, and as we'll see in the next slide, and you hit next and you go, oh, wait, no, sorry, there's another slide in between. I mean, we've all done that. So you don't have to worry about that kind of thing. So I set it to show me the current and the next slides. Then at the top of the screen, it shows you a clock. And if you tap on the clock, it toggles between showing you the time and how long has elapsed since you pressed play on the slideshow. So if you're in a TED-like environment where it's a strict 15-minute rule, then you want the second option where it shows you the elapsed time. But if you're in a meeting and you need to be out of the room by 12, then you want the other display. So whatever you need, you can get, which is wonderful to have that just sitting there instead of having to glance at your watch and stuff.
That's good.
And then there's a button to give you a drop-down of all of your slides. And so you can scan through those, and that won't come up at all on the presenter screen. So you can be flicking through, looking, jump back to slide 14 or whatever, find the slide, click on it, and then the screen jumps back to it. So you can navigate around your slides in privacy and all that kind of stuff. So it's really cool. And then sort of, as you would expect, you just tap the screen anywhere to make it go to the next slide. Or you can swipe if you prefer to swipe. And then obviously to go back, you swipe the other way. And the really cool thing, if you press and hold your finger, it becomes a fake laser pointer.
Oh, you're kidding.
I'm deadly serious. And as you move it around, it has a little tail that comes behind it as well.
As oh, if that's it was really awesome. A laser. Did you find and that you accidentally?
No, because the first time you run it, when you go into presenter mode, it puts up a tiny little pop-up that says, you are now in presenter mode, and here's what you can do.
Oh, cool. I did not find that. Okay, I'm a convert. All that stuff about it not working, I don't care. That's just cool.
And the little tail behind it is perfect. So even if you have it set up so there's two slides displayed at a time, you just press and hold on the current slide and move your finger about. And then you, literally what you point at on the iPad gets the red dot on the screen. And as you move it around, the dot has a little tail behind it like a real laser pointer would.
Does it show it to you on the iPad also? Or
well,
does
it's
it
where your finger is. I don't know if it's under the finger or not, but it's literally right where your finger is on the slide.
Oh, I see. I'm doing it right now. I'll be back a while. Oh, yeah, the faster you go, the longer the tail is. Whee! Yeah. Okay, you keep going. I'm just going to play here.
I did that too for a while. Actually, I have to say what I did before doing this for real is I went into work and I said, can I borrow the projector for an hour? And I tested it in the privacy of the conference room before doing it for real.
Nice.
And everyone came in for a demo because I said, by the way, if anyone's interested, you know, I have the adapter and I'm going to give it a test run. And I had loads of people come into me because they were interested and everyone was having fun with the laser pointer. Yeah, that was like, you know, I could have brought in a Wii or something. I would have given them around about the same level of entertainment. So anyway, so as you're presenting, it's a really nice interface and you can see what you have and what you have coming and you're just tapping to hit next, tapping to hit next, tapping to hit next. And it just really worked well. One thing I found that didn't work as it should is the iPhone or the remote. So there's another iOS app called Keynote Remote. I think it's like 79 cent or something. It's very cheap. And the theory is that over either Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, you can use the screen on your iPhone as your presenter display, effectively, and it will show you the current slide and or the next slide and let you swipe left and right to go forward.
Oh, that'd be cool, so you could walk around the room more?
So you could walk around the room, right? It doesn't do the laser pointer thing, but it does mean that you can have something small in your hand and walk around the room and just swipe with your thumb, say, or whatever. It works over Wi-Fi. I tested that at home, and I was like, I do not want to be relying on Wi-Fi in a conference room.
No.
Because I do not have control of it. Therefore, I'm not going to rely on it. So I read it up and it said Wi-Fi or Bluetooth. I said, okay, I'll enable Bluetooth on both devices and disable Wi-Fi on both devices and give it a test. Could not get the two of them to talk to each other.
And did it seem to be doing the right screens? Like it looked like it should have worked, it just wouldn't?
No, I just kept coming up with an error. Could not find. So you fire up the remote and then it gives you a code like Bluetooth to pair them.
Sure.
And so you go into Keynote and you say search for remotes and it's nothing here. Nothing to see here. And you try to link the remote. You can link either direction, actually. And whatever way you try to go, it's just, nope, I see nothing. Nothing here. Nothing to see here. So it really cranky about that. But so I didn't. In hindsight, I don't think it really matters because the presenter display on the iPad is infinitely better than on the remote. But if you're the kind of person who likes to walk around, you can't walk around with an iPad with a VGA dongle hanging out of it and a cable. But you can walk around with an iPhone.
Right,
so
right.
I guess that's where that comes in. So that was that, and I just kind of thought that was kind of cool. So the short version is it was a really positive experience. I actually found it easier to give my talk on the iPad than on my laptop.
Because
you just have the one screen which lies flat on the podium, so you don't have a stupid laptop screen sticking up
right at
an awkward angle and a keyboard where what you actually want to look at is. You just have the iPad lying there flat, you just plug it in, and then you literally just touch to highlight something. So you actually, if you want to underscore a point, you just click and hold and highlight it. It's very, very direct. I mean, you know, it's almost like taking a big stick and pointing at the screen, like in the olden days. But, you know, it's a little more direct. So, and just tap and tap instead of hammering the space bar. It's quieter, it's easier, and
just felt elegant, huh?
And I didn't have anything with me. I just had the iPad, and that was it, you know, and the one little cable.
You know,
instead of having to carry my laptop bag. So, you know, it was really nice to go to the talk without having to, you know, have a pack horse with me.
So I had a similar experience that was not on purpose. I went to a meeting in a conference room and the PC in the conference room had decided it had to go through some updates. It had to connect to servers. It had to, you know, what were your settings? You'd logged in. You hadn't been here before, blah, 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 blah. And the poor guy trying to run the meeting, it was like 11 minutes. And he still didn't have his stuff up, right? He had a PowerPoint presentation he was going to try to bring up. So he said, okay, screw it. I'm just going to start like drawing on the wall. Well, I happened to have been looking at the PowerPoint that he had mailed it out to us ahead of time, and he had drawn a diagram in PowerPoint. And I thought, you know what, this is the kind of diagram we're going to want to work on together. I wonder if I could build it in a wiki. So I'd opened up an internal to our company wiki, and I started drawing I drew it out in there with just a table, and I got it to kind of be serviceable. It was kind of ugly, but it was kind of fun. What's that?
It got the point across.
Yeah. It was a little dodgy, but, you know, it worked. And so anyway, he's drawn on the whiteboard, and I pulled out my iPad, and I VPN'd into the company, and I went to that wiki page. And, you know, being the kind of person I am, I had my iPad in my purse, and of course I had the VGA dongle in my purse. So I just very casually reached over and grabbed the VGA thing, plugged it in, and there it is up on screen. In like a quarter of the time that we had been unsuccessful, we were able to run the meeting from my iPad, and it was just beautiful. And everybody just kind of, and the subject was talking about writing iPad apps.
Yay.
We all kind of went, whoa.
That's pretty cool.
But you're right, it's very frictionless.
I have to say, because normally you're right, you open up the laptop and then you have 20 other apps running and so forth. With the iPad, you know, you're looking at it, you're on the first page of your presentation at home, you hit the lock button, you close over the cover, you go to your talk, you open up the cover, you plug in the VGA thing, you slide to unlock, and off you go.
Yeah. Well, what did you talk about?
Okay, so the talk itself is one I do every year, and it's sort of my way of sneaking some astronomy into people by the back door. So it's called Pondering the Mystery of the Christmas Star, which gets people to come along, and then I basically just teach them astronomy stuff. But what we do those stuff. So we sort of start off by reading the Bible passages, where I went to the bother of using a different font to make them stand out. And then we sort of say, okay, so what do we know about the star based on what it says in the Bible? And then we have a little look at the history and stuff. And then we get a timeline together, and then we go through the various astronomy bits. So the first thing to say is, I'm not going to go through a full version of the talk now, because the talk's an hour long, and our segment isn't. And we've already done quite a bit of recording. So the talk itself is sitting on iWork.com, where you can go get to it, and it's linked in the show notes.
Oh, look at that. How pretty.
Yeah. Now, the only thing to say is the videos don't seem to work on iWork.com.
Of course.
But other than that, it works fine.
Okay.
And the videos are not crucial. They're just nice to have. They're not needed. So if you want the full version of the talk, just go there and have a read. But basically, the short version is that Matthew and Luke sort of clash with each other, as in, if one is true, the other must be false.
Hmm.
And Luke doesn't mention a Christmas star at all, but Matthew does. So after a bit of, you know, it goes over about 10 slides to get to this point, we eventually get to the point where we say, we're going to ignore Luke and assume Matthew is correct. And then we go from there, and that
otherwise,
gives us sort of
no star to talk about.
Oh, precisely, which makes the talk really short. So that sort of gets us to the point where we say that what we know about the star is that they saw it at its rising, then it went before them, and then it to lead them to Herod's palace, and then so they saw the star at its rising. They jumped on their camels and tottered their way over to Herod's palace, where they had a little chat to Herod, and then the star, quote, went before them. And they followed it to Bethlehem, where it, quote, stopped. So you need to have three sightings. They need to see it when they're at home in Persia doing their Persian thing. Then they need to see it at Herod's palace. And then it needs to lead them to Bethlehem, where it needs to stop. And whatever astronomical phenomenon you're interested in, it has to fit those three descriptions, is kind of where we get to. And then the other thing we look at is sort of the context of the time, so we can kind of understand the people involved and the place. So we look at the interesting politics of the place, which is basically that Judea is sort of wedged between two empires. You have the Roman Empire and you have the Persian Empire, and you sort of have this no man's land in between, and there's kind of been a lot of wars and stuff, and Rome is in the process of actually taking it over. So the Romans did their normal Roman thing, and they don't just march in and take over straight away. They set up what they call a client king, which is basically a puppet king, who is, you know, officially he's the king of the Jews, and in reality he just does whatever Caesar tells him to, which is Herod the Great, and he gets popped in there. And then in 6 AD, they finish off the takeover, and they throw out the king, because what happens is Herod the Great is there, he dies in about 4 BC, and then his four sons each take over a quarter of the kingdom, and Judea goes to another Herod. And that other Herod gets booted out because the Judean people hate him. And the Romans just come in and take over.
And
that happens in I'm skipping Sumi sides here at a terrible pace. So that's sort of the politics going on. And then you have the fact that the three wise... Actually, we don't know there were three wise men. That's the other thing. We know that there were wise men and that they had three gifts. And everyone assumes three gifts means three wise men, but it could have been one generous wise man and one not so generous wise man. Or three wise men and a moocher who didn't bring a gift.
Or
so we don't know.
The gold
we know
was
there were
really heavy and it took three guys to carry it.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, gold, if it was a lot of gold, it's entirely plausible. So we know there were wise men, and we know that they came from the east of Judea, which means that they came from the Persian sort of Babylonian kind of area. So they were probably Zoroastrian priests. And the other thing to note is it's not easy to travel around 2,000 years ago in the Middle East. So your three sightings can't be a few hours apart, because you can't get, you know, the red eye from, you know, Babylon to Judea. You got to, you know, get on your camel and trek across the desert. So you're looking for weeks, which has, A, you need a long gap between your sightings, and B, you kind of, it's a big deal. So you got to get your whole court together, and you're going to need a whole bunch of servants and stuff with you. You basically need a camel train and lots of food and lots of supplies and lots of people. So you don't do it on a whim. So whatever this star thing was, it's got to have really convinced these astrologer priests that it was worth all that effort, because they were gone for months, and, you know, it's not a cheap undertaking. So we basically, given all that, we're looking for something which has a strong astrological significance. It should also be mentioned that there were some prophecies which predate, so they're Old Testament prophecies that are relevant here. And I'm not going to read them out because they're all funny old speak with funny names. But basically you have the Bethlehem prophecy and the star prophecy, and they basically talk about a king of the Jews showing up in Bethlehem and a star presaging a coming of a new king of the Jews. And you put the two of those together and you get star leading to Jesus.
And this so you're getting into some stuff I hadn't actually known, which is that it was because the star was there that they were saying, oh, well, okay, that prophecy is true, so we should go follow it and see what's at the end?
Well, you can look at it both ways around. So you could be saying they were looking for a star because the prophecies existed.
Sure.
Or they saw a star and gave it more credence because the prophecies existed. But either way...
But it's unlikely to be a star that was visible before that.
Well, whatever. I mean, the prophecies make it much more likely that you will jump on your camel and do your three-month trek. Because you're an astrologer, you're waiting for something to happen. You have a prophecy that there is going to be a new king of the Jews, and he's going, and his arrival is going to be preceded by a star. So, you know, it makes it all a lot more plausible than just, I see something in the sky, I know, let's get on a camel. I mean, you know, you got to kind of get there. The other important thing to say is that the word star doesn't mean what it used to mean. We think of the word star as being a very specific term, an incandescent mass. I can't remember the song now, but anyway, you know, mostly hydrogen turning into helium, incandescent mass, blah, blah, blah. But in the olden, you know, a few thousand years ago, the word star was used to describe anything that happened in the sky. If it happened in the night sky, it was a star. So we need to be much broader in our thinking than just, you know, big balls of hydrogen and helium burning. So we have to think of that. And the other thing that comes to mind is, right, we know that 2 years after the nativity, Herod goes around and kills all the kids who are less than 2 years old, so that he kills the future king of the Jews, because he's king of the Jews and we don't want another one, it's me. So Herod needed the wise men to go and find Jesus for him, because he actually says, you know, you go and find the child and let me know where he is so I can come and pay him homage. And then the wise men have a dream where angels tell them, don't go back to Herod, so they don't, and they go home by a different way, and Herod's kind of left waiting, and after 2 years of waiting, he goes, right, kill them all. But the point is, Herod couldn't see the star. So whatever the star was, it was probably something not very obvious unless you were an astrologer priest. So you need something which has massive meaning to astrologers, but that an ordinary pleb can't walk out and look up, you know, so it's not going to be an arrow-shaped constellation pointing at Bethlehem or something. It's going to be something more subtle. So meaning for the wise men, but not for Herod. So if we skip over some stuff here, basically, if you go into the history, you have Josephus was a Jewish historian who wrote about the time. We have Roman records. we have some names mentioned in the Bible passages that tie us to actual Roman rulers of Syria. So a chap called Quirinius comes into it. And if you take all of that evidence and the fact that Herod had to be alive 2 years after the Nativity, because if he was dead, he couldn't have ordered all the babies killed.
Oh, right, right.
You end up with a timeline that the most likely time for this to have happened was between 6 and 8 AD, or BC.
Okay.
So that's sort of the search window we need to do our searching in.
It's funny that it doesn't encompass zero.
There is no zero.
How is there no zero? There's BC and AD.
From 1 AD to 1 BC, there is no zero.
Okay. All right. But we would think it would have happened between 1 and negative 1.
Well, if you think about how much we've been messing with the calendar over the last 2,000 years, had it actually happened on zero, on zero.
And then there's leap year and the whole thing.
Yeah, we forgot about those for a couple of centuries. And there was also, no one actually got around to calculating when we should start our years until something like 400 AD was when someone said, we need a new calendar, and because we're all Christian here in Europe now, we should base it on the birth of Christ. So let's go figure out when that was.
Ah,
but that's not easy to do, because before we had a calendar we all agreed on, everyone had their own calendar. Okay. And getting those to all mesh together correctly was quite error-prone. So the fact that we lost a couple of years, it shouldn't come as a surprise.
Okay.
So the candidate objects, I basically went through and looked for all the things people have suggested on the internet and then used that as an excuse to talk about those things. Now, we're running short on time, so I'm going to be very quick.
But I really recommend you guys, while he's been talking, I've been flipping through these charts and looking at, he's got great pictures and he's got, he's delineated for each one of these possibilities. He shows in green, you know, what makes you think that might be the right answer, but then he shows you in red why it couldn't have been the answer. I'm not all the way through to find out what the answer is, but this is really, really fun. I like the way you formatted it and the way it draws you into the story.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to immediately dismiss a bunch of these. I'm going to say, aurorae were suggested by some people. My conclusion comes down to very unlikely. Lots of red on that page. The next thing someone suggested is shooting stars, which I also come down pretty hard on in the red, and I put that one down as very unlikely. And then we get to one that everyone sort of thinks of because of Christmas cards. A comet, of course.
Yeah.
We all think of that. So a comet is just, you know, a ball of, a dirty snowball, I think is what astronomers call comets. So basically you have a bunch of water ice and a bunch of dust and ache. And it spins around the sun in a really elliptical orbit. So when it's far away from the sun, it's very cold and frozen solid. And then it comes close to the sun and it begins to melt. And stuff flies off as it melts. And that stuff flying off gives us the comet's tail. And if any of that stuff flying off happens to have an electric charge, then that part of the tail will point exactly away from the sun at all times, and so you might have two tails on a comet. So one tail of not charged stuff just falling off, and one tail of charged stuff being perfectly aligned with the sun's field and pointing always straight away from the sun. But the kind of the big problem with comets are that, A, we didn't kind of have any visible at the right time. There was one in 5 BC, but that doesn't really fit our exact time period. And a slight problem is that astrologically, they imply doom, death, destruction, and generally negative things. Which isn't kind of what we're looking for at the, you know, for the birth of an entire religion and the savior of mankind. It doesn't fit. And also the minor fact that Herod might have noticed. He could have walked out and seen a great big V in the sky. So that one doesn't fit. So we dismissed that one. Then we get into the more interesting ones, like variable stars are really subtle, because a variable star is just a star, and there was no light pollution in 2000 BC, so when you went out at night, you saw a lot of stars. And no normal person who's not an astrologer, an astronomer, is going to notice one less or one more, let alone one that's a bit brighter than it used to be.
Sure.
That's going to be not obvious, and it's going to have astrological significance because it's going to be in a constellation. There's no way for a star not to be in a constellation. So if you sort of stretch things a bit and you say, well, possibly, maybe, you know, you're getting into slightly plausible, but it's still not very convincing. And similarly, you have novae and supernovae, which we now understand them as different things, but their effect on the sky is the same. No star there? Oh, look, a star there now. And then a few weeks later, no star there again. So again, not obvious to regular folks, but very obvious to astrologers, particularly if a supernova or a nova were to go off in an important constellation that they were really watching, because they would have mapped parts of the world onto parts of the sky, so you would have constellations associated with Judea. And if you're looking for a king of the Jews and a new star just pops up in the middle of that constellation, that might make you go, ooh. So that's slightly plausible, except for the minor fact that we don't have any that fit our search space. They also kind of don't move. So this whole going before, stopping, all of that language doesn't hold up. And that really takes us on into sort of what the actual thing where the slide goes all green, which is that the most likely explanation is some form of what I call planetary phenomena, because the planets, that we know them as planets now, but they just look like dots on the sky. If you've ever seen Jupiter or Saturn on the night sky, it just looks like a star. But what happens to those stars is that if you look at them for day after day after day, you'll notice that they slowly move relative to all the other stars in the sky. And our word for planet actually comes from, I think it's the Latin or the Greek for wandering star, because they're just stars that slowly move around relative to all the other stars. And they can do all sorts of cool things. So they can move around and they can come very close to each other. That's called a conjunction. They are in constellations. If they're further out from the sun than us, they do this strange thing every year where they temporarily go backwards, which is called retrograde.
Oh, yeah. I actually learned about that for the first time at the planetarium this summer.
Excellent. So basically, because our orbit is inside the outer planet's orbit, and the closer into the sun you are, the quicker you go. So we basically pass them out. And as we're doing that, you know, they're moving one way, and then they slow down, then they come to a stop, and then they start accelerating off in the other way, they slow down, they come to a stop, and then they go back to the normal direction. So you get that sort of, it's called a retrograde loop, where it's forward, 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 slow down, stop, backward, 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 slow down, stop, and then forward again. And that's astrologically very important. And those points where it changes direction are called stationary points and will be referred to as a planet stopping, which begins to get us into the kind of language that we're looking for. Because we want, you know, the star stopped, stood over, that kind of stuff.
Right, right, right.
So they can have conjunctions where planets come close together, and you can have a conjunction of 1, 2, or 20, 30 planets. Not 20, 30, we don't have that many. But you can have lots of planets come together, and you can also have occultations, which is where one planet passes in front of another, or much more likely, where the moon passes between us and a planet, and on the sky, the moon appears to block out the planet. And that has massive importance astrologically. And then you can also have the planets coming very close to bright stars that are important for some reason. Like you have a star called Regulus, which I guess Harry Potter fans will know. But Regulus is a star associated with royalty, which is the brightest star in the constellation of Leo. And Leo being a zodiac constellation, of course, the planets pass through it. And planets can come into conjunction with that star, which could have important meaning. So you've all these possible planetary things that could be going on. And if you look back, so you rewind time, you end up with three candidates, and I'm going to skip over the two that I don't think are most likely. I'm going to jump straight to the answer because I can just see Allison getting itchy for time.
Yeah, I do have a haircut. You can keep going. I'll just go get my haircut, though.
No. So we'll skip. If you're interested in the others, we'll skip the. You can read them in the slides. And the other thing I do in the slides is I change the color of the slide and have these aside sessions where I describe, you know, what it means to be in conjunction, what it means to be in retrograde, and all that kind of stuff. But basically, what happened in... let me get the exact year here. What happened sorry. I hate jumping through my slides like this. 7 BC, which is exactly between 6 and 8, which fits well, is we had what's called the triple conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. So if you take retrograde loops, you have planets going forward and backwards, and if you overlap two retrograde loops, what can happen is that the planets can appear to come together into conjunction, move apart, come back together into conjunction, move apart, and then finally come back together into conjunction and then really move apart.
Oh.
And that gives you three sightings, and it happens in the right time frame. And the conjunctions took place in the constellation of Pisces, which was astrologically associated with Judaism. And Jupiter is the planet associated with Judea. So you have the constellation of the Jews, you have the planet, the king planet, which is Jupiter, which is also associated with Judea, in the constellation of the Jews. Triple conjunctions are very, very rare. So this, you know, that is, in my opinion, the most plausible of the three explanations.
And do we think one happened? We do know one happened back then?
We do know a triple conjunction happened, yes. We have 7 BC, okay. We have the exact dates. And that's one thing the video shows is what happens when you see it. But you can actually take any astronomy program of your choice and rewind it to 7 BC and watch for yourself. And you'll see them come together, move apart a lot, then come together and move apart a little, and then come together, which gives you long gap for get on camel, go to Herod's palace, and short gap for get from Herod's palace, arrive in Bethlehem. Which
is
what you want.
The way you describe it.
So, My personal, the conclusion I actually come to is that I don't think any of them actually happened.
After but, all this?
Yeah, but as I say, it's my excuse for an astronomy discussion. So when I give this talk for real, the bit that I skipped over is me describing what are aurorae, what are comets, what are novae, what are supernovae. So I can teach all of these concepts in a Christmas talk, and everyone has a good time, and they've learned a bunch of astronomy without meaning to. That's kind of the logic to it. So basically, I sort of fall down. I think it's probably no secret that I'm not an actively practicing Christian. I sort of put myself in the agnostic category. So I sort of think that the star was retroactively put in there by the people writing the Gospels so as to add the appropriate gravitas. But again, that's just my opinion, and I'm not suggesting everyone believe that. That's just what I came to.
But you say it is scientifically possible that there was something exactly like what they said.
Absolutely. So we have three good candidates. One really good candidate, which fits into the time frame the best. So there's no reason to assume that it didn't happen, and we have good candidates that it could have happened, but to me there's no evidence it did either, so I just come on one side of it. Basically, I hope people can read through the talk and make up their own mind. I'm not trying to lead people to a conclusion. I want people to make their own choice and to teach them some astronomy on the way. That's sort of my logic.
Very cool. This presentation is really, really neat. I really encourage you guys to take a look. You know, I'm wondering, Bart, is it possible to link to those videos that we can't watch?
It is.
I mean, I'm assuming they're not videos you created yourself, so maybe a link in there.
Well, they are, and the story of how they came into being is fun. They were animated GIFs that I used ScreenFlow to turn into movie.
Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh!
Screen capture, because this is, yeah.
Oh, cool.
There's a reason in that.
Well, after all that work, I want you to put them online and link to them.
What I actually have, you see, is you can export from Keynote into QuickTime. Instead of into either PowerPoint or PDF.
Mm. And then it would
And if you do it in QuickTime, it's a movie, and every time you hit space, it advances a slide. And when you get to the movies, it just plays them.
Ah, well, that's another way to go.
It's a big file, but today's Saturday when we're recording this, and you don't put the show out until Sunday, so if I upload it overnight, I can give you a link.
Awesome.
So I will
do
that.
I think you should.
Yes, I'll do that, and then people can get the full experience. And the nice thing when you do it as a video file instead of as a PPT or whatever, is that you also get the transitions, which is total fluff, but it means you get the cool OS X style rotate and stuff.
Hey, Bart, this is fantastic. I do need to cut you off, though, because if I miss this haircut appointment, I'm going to be mistaken for the Shaggy Dog here, so I better get us going.
Very good. Right. I think we've already picked a Christmas time, because I think we're getting into that season, but we've already arranged the time, so I think in 2 weeks from now, I'll be talking to you again. So happy computing until then.
Okay, last week he forgot to say until then happy computing. This time he says happy computing until then. I don't know. This is too much change. Too much change. I like tradition. Well, anyway, this is going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills, Screen Steps, and Smile. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. I'm on there a lot, and I contribute a fair amount over on Google Plus nowadays. In fact, you can see my photos of the eclipse if you join up with me on Google Plus. So just search for me by name there if you want to circle me up. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time, and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. And don't forget to sign up for the Nocilla Castaways party in San Francisco in January. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.